On Tech News Today, we've got new information on France's right to be forgotten ultimatum for Google. Plus, Twitter finds new ways to take your money, and the FCC gets all warm and fuzzy on us. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, June 19th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is Mashable senior tech correspondent Christina Warren. How the heck are you, Christina?
I'm very good. I'm very good. How about you, Mike?
I'm doing great. Now, you guys have a new person reviewing products. Can you tell us about your new intern?
We do. We have a new intern. His name is Newt. He's from the state of Georgia, where I'm also from. And before becoming a product reviewer, he was well-known in political circles and was actually Speaker of the House. Yeah. Newt Gingrich reviewed the Apple Watch for us, which, you know what? Honestly, when I didn't really have a lot to do with this other than tweeting that I thought the idea would be hilarious and, encouraging the people who actually did all the hard work. But I was a little bit cautious. I was like, is this going to be okay? It turned out he's actually a really good reviewer. Like, he's reviewing this the way that, you know, a guy kind of his era who's a gearhead would review a product. And he had some really good insights, I thought. So the video is super funny. Cory Booker makes an appearance, which is very funny. And that was not planned. That just happened when our team was out in Washington, D.C. interviewing him for the product review. So, yeah, Newt Gingrich. Writing for Mashable.
Unbelievable. I didn't see that coming. And he's always been a big tech enthusiast. So that's very cool to see him doing stuff like that. Well, let's jump into our top story. We've been talking about France's ultimatum for Google. Censor the global internet according to Europe's right to be forgotten rules or else face a big fine. Search Engine Land's editor-in-chief Danny Sullivan is the only journalist I'm aware of who's been doggedly pestering the authorities to answer a fundamental question about all this. Do the French insist that the internet is censored globally for everyone, or globally only for French or European citizens? And he finally got his answer. Danny joins us now. Welcome to you, Danny.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, first things first, you posted this story at 3 a.m. Were you up late or early?
I actually was up late, but I was, and of course I'm Pacific time, so it wasn't so bad for me. But I had written it a couple hours earlier and posted it, or had it go live at, 9 a.m. French time, because it's applicable over there as well, so...
So, well, we're glad that you were, as Mike said, covering this doggedly, and we really appreciate it. So what is the answer? Is France ultimatum?
So,
what's the answer?
I mean, to back up just a bit, the big question was, until now, when these right to be forgotten requests have come in, Google has said, okay, we'll take that off of Google France, which means Google.fr. And so if you were in France and you went to Google.com, you would still see these results. And not that many people do that, but the various EU authorities have been saying, no, we think you should censor these things, on all your domains. So then the question was, well, do you mean censor on all the domains for people physically within your country? Or do you mean you think this material should be removed for everybody worldwide? And so that's what I called both the easy and the hard solution. The easy thing is we could just censor for everything within the boundaries of France or within the boundaries of the EU. And the data regulatory agency, surprised me by saying, well, no, we want something even different. We want these results to be censored for all French citizens, whether they are in France or whether they are, say, working in Chile. And I was really kind of astounded, because it was like, well, you're kind of tacked with privacy, and yet for Google to censor results for French citizens, that implies that they have to know who is a French citizen. And so how do you propose to do that? And they don't really have an answer to that. And I don't know how Google there's no foolproof way Google could do this. So that's one issue. And then another issue is that if they are required to do this outside the physical boundaries of one country, then that opens up every country to be that, have the same sort of thing happen. And so, for example, Russia right now is very close to having their own right to be forgotten law. That would be very broad. That seems like it would allow anybody to say, I want this stuff removed from search results, and it has to happen worldwide. And so you could imagine that maybe there's some stuff that people in France think is really relevant politically, but you've got a Russian politician who might say, I want all this stuff out, and Google has to remove it from not just Russia, but for everybody worldwide, or, you know, maybe just Russian citizens worldwide. I don't know.
Is this the future of the internet? Is this something that the search engines will have to offer, which is censorship as a service?
I think that they're overdue from this, what I call the myth of censorship, where they would remove it from a country-specific domain, but not other domains for people in that country. So, like I said, if you were in France and you went to Google.com, you got these uncensored search results. And that really isn't keeping in with the spirit of meeting the local laws. But everybody has kind of allowed that as sort of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge thing, either knowingly or unknowingly. That's how it's happened. And so I think it's reasonable to say that, you know, countries have censorship laws. Some of them we don't agree with, some of them we do agree with or think make sense. And if you're going to implement those laws, then you probably do need to implement them for everybody within the boundaries of a particular country. But I think it gets very tricky when one country demands censorship happen outside their physical boundaries. And I hope that that isn't the future. And I think it may not be the future in part because it's also very difficult to do.
One thing that's different about the right to be forgotten stuff, though, is you talk about the censorship we agree with and the censorship we don't agree with. In the case of, like, let's say the censorship that the United States imposes around, let's say, child pornography. Okay, child pornography is censored in the United States. We all agree with it. More to the point, it's against the law. Child pornography is against the law. The right to be forgotten is interesting because it censors links to legal content. In other words, the information that would be linked to without the right to be forgotten are articles on the Guardian newspaper and Le Monde. And so that's one of the bizarre differences with this. Or is that not a relevant difference? Do you think that that's...
Well, it's... While the content itself isn't illegal, the law, as interpreted by the European Court of Justice, is that Google is effectively a data collection agency, like an Experian, let's say. And that as such, it has to allow people to edit their records in the way that we might edit our credit records if they have issues. And so while the material isn't illegal, there are legal provisions that people should be able to have this stuff removed from the search results. And I think that even in some cases, people will agree. You know, they think, hey, okay, in some cases, we could think a right to be forgotten for certain circumstances makes sense. And so we've been kind of feeling our way on how this sort of stuff happens. But it is a good point where you make, like, you know, with child pornography, if Google removes that in one country, they're probably going to remove it everywhere, in part, even if it's not illegal in a particular country, because Google itself might think, we just don't want that content. Another example is with the DMCA, and that's the one big exception here, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. If Google removes content under U.S. law that's deemed to be a copyright violation, it removes that globally for everybody under U.S. law because it, you know, it's in part because it's based in the U.S. and also because I just think they've never thought about the fact that they're imposing a U.S. censorship law on the rest of the world. But, you know, they also seem to feel like, well, if it's a copyright violation, I guess it's a copyright violation and we'll act on it from there.
Right. I mean, I think this is interesting, but, you know, obviously talking about copyright violations or things that are crimes, much more in the sense rather than, you know, provisions that are kind of these sanctioned things, I think it's, as Mike pointed out, it's different. And as you say, but maybe that doesn't matter. But what do you think the likelihood is that Google's actually going to implement any of these things? I mean, what do you think the likelihood is that they're just going to say, we reject this decision and we will pull these from Google.fr, but if you're wanting these other things, it's not technically feasible for us to do it. And frankly, we won't do it because we don't feel that we're required to based on, you know, the EU doesn't control us. What do you think the chances are that they're just going to kind of thumb their noses at it?
I think it's reasonable that they will say, okay, we're going to censor for all the various Google editions we offer within France or within the EU. It's a very simple thing for them to do that. It shouldn't have that great of an impact, given that very few people actually seem to use these anyway. I think it's very unlikely that they're going to say we're going to impose global censorship. If people are not within the EU, we're not going to impose this kind of right to be forgotten censorship outside the EU when people are outside the EU. And that's the fight that I think that they'll end up having if it goes that way. Because it becomes very, very difficult. And they may feel at that point it's worth having that fight. And I think that you may also find people in the EU, when they kind of wake up to, if you want to impose your censorship on people who are not within your physical boundaries, for whatever good reasons that you think are applying, other countries can do the same thing to your citizens within your country. And I think that they'll start to find examples where they go, oh, we don't want that to happen.
I think that if I accidentally see the Hulk Hogan sex tape, I have the right to forget that. But that's my own personal.
I'd just like to censor that from. I've never watched it.
Yeah,
I want to even censor the concept from my head.
I don't even want to think about it. Danny Sullivan is at searchengineland.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Danny Sullivan. Thank you so much, Danny. Great job as always, and we'll see you sometime soon.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right. Bye. Well, Twitter is rolling out two new ways to interact. One is product-specific pages, and the other is called collections, which include products and places where users can actually buy stuff. Kurt Wagner writes for Recode and joins us now. Welcome to you, Kurt.
Hey, good morning, Mike. How's it going?
It's going great, thanks. Now, can these product pages be set up only by the manufacturer of those products, or can stores do it, or can anyone do it? Who gets to set up product pages?
So right now, Twitter's partnering with, I believe it's 41 different brands and kind of celebrities, people like Ellen DeGeneres. And those people have the ability to create these product pages and these collections, which means that they're essentially picking products. If they're a brand, it's probably one of their own products. If it's someone like Ellen, it's maybe one of her own products, maybe something she's demonstrated on her show. And they're setting these up like specific pages where, as a user, I can go, I can see, okay, what are people saying about this product on Twitter? What's the price? What are possibly some reviews about it? And then maybe if I'm intrigued, I could even buy it from Twitter. So ultimately, it's kind of a two-part initiative from Twitter. They're saying, hey, look, we have all this data about products. Let's use it to help people maybe shop. And then the second part is, let's sell some stuff and eventually make some revenue.
So let's go back to this collections thing for a second, just so I can be clear on this. So it's basically like, you know, when Oprah used to do her My Favorite Things list. It's kind of like that, where, like, you know, X person or X brand is like, here's a collection of things that we like. Maybe if you're a store for summer or Father's Day, or if you're a celebrity, hey, these are my favorite, you know, X products for this. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. And obviously, it just started rolling out this morning. So the few collections that I've seen so far do fall basically exactly how you just described. I think the Ellen one, and looks like we're taking a look at the what it looks like right now on mobile. I think that's probably the ideal example, right? It's like, here's a bunch of things that Ellen DeGeneres thinks are cool or wants you to know about. And as a consumer, you can say, okay, I want to see what's up with Ellen, or I want to see what's up with Nike right now, because it's the middle of summer and maybe they got some cool shorts that I need to buy. And so that's the idea, is that these brands get to kind of curate what you see and give you some options of things that you might be interested in that you didn't probably know it even existed before.
I'm sure the Ellen page will be interesting, but I can't wait to see the Christina page. That should be good.
Seriously, I was going to ask, can regular people be part of this, or do you have to be a brand or celebrity?
Right now, it appears to be just brands and celebrities. So I would imagine that eventually, I would imagine eventually you'd be able to like curate your own list. But that sounds very Pinterest-like, doesn't it?
You know, you're pinning things. Well, this whole thing sounds very Pinterest-like. I was going to say this whole thing is very, very. Twitter's like, okay, we can't be Facebook, so we want to be Pinterest now.
Right. Well, I will say this: Twitter has always dealt with this issue of search. Right. I mean, when you think about trying to find a tweet after it's gone through your timeline, it's basically impossible unless you remember the exact person and time that they tweeted. So I think that it's good that they're trying to make this effort to kind of curate stuff a little bit more, because there is a lot of good content on Twitter. We just don't always see it. So you're kind of seeing some of the products that they've rolled out, the Lightning project that was mentioned yesterday. BuzzFeed had a good story about that. I mean, these projects both involve kind of taking all the tweets that are out there and making them easier to find. So I think that that's a good thing. And that's obviously something Pinterest has spent a lot of time trying to do on their site as well.
Yeah, you referred to Project Lightning, which we talked about yesterday. Now, how would Twitter monetize this? I mean, first of all, will they have my credit card on file and I'll just be able to click a button like Amazon and buy stuff? Or is there some other process? And how will they monetize this?
So with the new product pages, I think the most obvious monetization option would be to take a cut of sales that happen, right? So if I'm a brand and or I buy some shorts from Nike, maybe Twitter gets a small percentage of that for kind of leveraging that sale. Right now, they're not making any revenue splits with their partners, so that would be something that could happen down the road. I think the other thing is maybe they think, okay, brands may be more likely to advertise these products. So if I'm a brand and I know that I have my collection page, maybe I want to tweet some of those products out and promote those tweets so that more people see them. So I think that, you know, perhaps as a side effect, Twitter may boost its ad revenue by people trying to simply get these products in front of people. But then also, I think the revenue split thing seems like a logical option for them at some point down the road.
So here's my final question for you, Kurt. Do you think that users actually want this, that users are actually going to find a way to shop? Because on the one hand, I don't mind finding collections and seeing products people recommend. I can see the value in seeing tweets and this sort of thing. But if I'm being honest, whereas it makes total sense from a Pinterest perspective to have buy pins, right? Because I usually am going there with the intent of shopping, and I'm going there kind of with the intent of kind of, you know, pasting things up and putting things on wish lists. But with Twitter, you know, I'm not necessarily seeing that as a shopping destination. So do you think that this is something that the users will even bother to engage with, or do you think this is just yet another, you know, avenue that Twitter's trying to pull to, you know, find itself some business model beyond its mobile advertising?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm with you. I can't really imagine myself going to Twitter as a destination for shopping, and maybe that's not the ultimate goal here. But I will say this. I think that because Twitter's so involved with live events, I think they kind of have a unique opportunity that not a lot of other, probably no other company out there really has, which is to be following an event live on Twitter, we'll say the Oscars. Maybe something happens at the Oscars on TV. You check Twitter, and all of a sudden, oh, wow, I can buy, you know, this probably wouldn't be for me, but oh, wow, I can buy that dress that I just saw Jennifer Lopez wearing on TV. Or you're watching the basketball game and it's like, oh, the Warriors just won the championship. I'm going to buy my Warriors championship t-shirt right on Twitter because I've already been following the game right there. So perhaps it's better for like spur of the moment purchases, things that just kind of you weren't expecting to buy and all of a sudden they came across your feed and there you go. It does seem like it would be maybe a tough place to really be like a destination shopping site. But I don't know. It's obviously just rolled out, so we'll have to see. I'm kind of with you, though. I just don't know if this is something I would use heavily. But there's 300 million people on Twitter. I'm sure some of them are going to use it to buy products.
Kurt Wagner has a dream job at Recode.net. He's on social media all day, and they pay him for it. Kurt Wagner is at KurtWagner8 on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kurt.
Yes, thanks for having me, guys. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Well, the FCC voted yesterday to both subsidize internet connectivity for the poor and also crack down on robocalls. Christina Warren, what happened to the FCC of late? I mean, I have a theory. Tom Wheeler of the FCC used to be, remember when he was like the evil, like, shill of the industry? Right about
he was
the time,
show.
Yeah, but right, but and he then he became warm and fuzzy right about the time that marijuana was legalized in Washington, D.C. Coincidence?
You know what? It might be, or maybe not. I don't know. That would be amazing if that were the actual rationale. I think what happened is that, I mean, maybe he's like the rare like public servant who actually is wanting to listen to the people. But you're right. He goes from being like being the mouthpiece for the cable industry and having these kind of net neutrality, you know, laws that were not going to work. And then realizing that the public was like, this is unacceptable. He totally had a 180 on that. And now they're cracking down on robocalls, which is amazing. So, interesting stuff.
Yeah. And first it was net neutrality and stuff. And one theory is that he might be wanting to run for office and not, you know, getting out of the sort of regulatory business. What he's supposed to do is just do the revolving door and go right back into the industry. But maybe he's got another plan. Now, this is a really interesting story for multiple reasons, one of which is the politics behind this. As with net neutrality, the Democrats on the FCC were in favor of the subsidy for the poor. The Republicans were against it. This is essentially a logical expansion of the Lifeline proposal.
Yes, it is.
Which is being seriously criticized by Republicans in Congress. Right. But this was created by Ronald Reagan. This is a Republican initiative.
It was. And you're right. I mean, it kind of shows, I think, just how much partisan politics have changed in the last 30 years. Because if you were to look at a lot of Reagan's positions on a lot of areas, you know, he, even though he is held up by conservatives as the ultimate kind of figure of the GOP, you know, he's their mascot. A lot of his positions are things that the modern GOP would not vote in favor of. If those things were said by someone on their side now, they might even be called a gasp, you know, progressive. But this is actually, you know, these proposals that is now going to go to, you know, the vote passed 3-2 and they're now going to be, you know, taking it to the next level is basically exactly that. It's an expansion of the Lifeline program, which was basically to help subsidize phone stuff and long distance and local phone calls, and now saying that it could go to broadband. And if you think about it, that makes complete and total sense, because what phone service was, you know, 30 years ago, and how important it was for people to have access, you know, to a phone line 30 years ago, it's that important for people to have access to data now. I mean, I would venture to say that more people use data on their phones than they do voice. And I mean, I know I certainly do. And I think having some sort of, you know, broadband initiative to make sure that the whole country is connected is very important.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And the other aspect of this, of course, the robocall part of it is, it's a bunch of common sense rules. So, for example, if somebody requests to be taken off the list, they have to be taken off the list. The telemarketers have one shot to call the person. Right. If they connect to the person, they can't just keep calling them over and over again. The problem that I'm going to have with this, of course, is that there are already laws in the books that protect consumers from robocalls, and it's a matter of enforcement. It's a matter of chasing down every single violation and figuring out what's going on. These things are automated and computerized, and there's an evolutionary arms race between the regulatory bodies and the industry, which is trying to find a way to sell stuff by phone. And so this, I think, is just a temporary benefit. I'm sure that the spammers will figure out how to get around it.
I was going to say, I mean, it's similar to the spam can laws, you know, that apply to email. You know, they have these provisions in place, and that's great. And that means that the people that are actually following the rules and are, I guess, on the level of the robocaller, so to speak, they will follow those rules. But there are so many people out there who just don't, who just are kind of off the radar and aren't operating legitimately anyway. You know, the latest thing I've started noticing, I don't know about you guys, is I get calls to my Google Voice number from someone with a very strong, Indian accent, basically, saying that they're from a pharmacy offering to sell me, you know, I'm getting like cheap Viagra offers over the phone now. So literally my spam email has now become spam phone calls.
Wow.
And so, and that's not even robocalls. These are actual people who are calling. So on the one hand, I think this is great. On the other hand, I agree with you. And at a certain point, it's kind of a piranha. It's like, okay, you know, or a hydra rather, you know, you dump it and you cut it down and it just comes back up again.
Yeah. My solution is I just never answer my phone.
I've kind of started to do that, but I hate that, because then I'll miss a call from an important person and go, oh well, yeah, and just I'm antisocial now. I don't answer my phone. Text me, tweet me, DM me, you know.
Exactly.
Me,
I think my loved ones have accepted that fact. Now we got some breaking news from Google, which posted a blog post a few minutes ago saying that they're taking action against revenge porn. They're setting up a site where anybody can go and request that revenge porn be taken down, and they will honor those requests, according to this blog post. Yeah, so that is just breaking now. It's a post by Amit Singhal, who's a senior vice president of search at Google. Very, very interesting. Well, we got some more news for you in just a minute, but first, let's talk about Braintree. Braintree is a full-stack payment solution that makes it easy to select payments in your app or on your website. If you unless you're new to the planet, you have used Braintree already when you've gone to Airbnb, Uber, Lyft, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, Muntree, and a whole bunch of other really popular sites that are popular in part because they're so easy to deal with the payments. And this is what Braintree specializes in. Easy for the people buying stuff and easy for the people who have the websites and apps that are selling stuff. You can simply use their multiple lines of code, and you don't have to deal with all these different financial providers. They will do all that for you. You just put in the Braintree code, and you're off and running. You can do that like 30 minutes or so. depending on your experience. You can take every type of currency you can imagine, even Bitcoin. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types, and you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, and more, all with a single integration. You can take money in more than 130 currencies. I can't even name a dozen, but they'll take more than 130. So it's very nice internationally. And this will happen across all platforms with superior fraud protection, superior customer service, and really fast payouts. You want to learn more, and to do that and to get your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/TNT. Google is curating eyewitness videos of major news events on a new channel called YouTube Newswire. The new resource is being launched in partnership with the social news agency Storyful, which will verify the videos as either authentic or not authentic. The inauthentic ones will be removed from the site or will never appear on the site. Google is also launching a resource called the First Draft Coalition, which is designed to teach people how to verify eyewitness coverage, and including journalists. And the third initiative is called Witness Media Lab, which will create in-depth feature videos about the people affected by various major news events. Christina Warren, this is part of a larger trend in figuring out how to fix what's broken in the world of news. But I think this looks like great stuff.
This is fantastic. And I love that they're partnering with Storyful on this, because Storyful, which now is owned by News Corp, they do a great job. You know, they employ journalists who verify, you know, the tweets, the videos, the Instagram photos are legitimate. And they really help curate them to help tell the story that's happening from the ground. And as we've seen, even with the tragedy yesterday, in Charleston or Wednesday night, I suppose, so much important information comes from on the ground first, because oftentimes that's what's getting out there faster than the mainstream media, frankly. And it's great to be able to have a place to kind of curate, audited sources of news, to be able to say, yes, look, we know that this is legitimate and this is real. But I also think that the educational aspect of showing people how to verify coverage, and also how to, focusing on people affected by these events. I think all three of these initiatives are great, and I'm really glad Google is doing this.
Yeah, it's really a fantastic month for news resources, Christina, because essentially what's happened is in the history of the internet since the 90s, all these companies, especially Google-like companies, have been figuring out how to replace human curation and human editorial judgment with algorithms and software and social curation and so on.
Now we're going back.
Yes, because nobody...
Because it doesn't work.
Exactly. I mean, if those of us who are in journalism could have guessed that this would be the case, because the qualities that it takes, things like not just reason, but experience, intuition, good taste... judgment, awareness of what else is going on, just being in tune with the readership and what their sensibilities are. Those things can't be replicated by algorithms and won't be for decades at least.
Exactly. At some point, we might be able to recreate that je ne sais quoi, that makes something different. But until then, you're right. I've had debates with some of our algorithm guys, our data scientists here at Mashable. We've had fun debates about who could write the better headline, the reporter or the algorithm. And in a lot of cases, I think the algorithm might be better or just as good. But when it really comes down to getting the best headline, your best headline is going to be a reporter who's informed by knowing, for instance, what's happening, knows the history, knows the audience. And the same goes with news judgment. It comes with curation. And certainly, I think there's a place for algorithms, right? Like, even with this sort of service that they're creating, they're working with Storyful to verify the videos. But you can use technology to pull in things from certain, locations and certain time periods. And you can analyze videos maybe for certain types of objects. And you can do a lot to cull down the vast amount of information that's out there. So you can use the technology to kind of sift through everything and then use a human to go through and say, okay, these are the things that are important and this is what should be highlighted. And I think that I'm really glad that we're finally, especially Google, who historically has been so bad about accepting any sort of human intervention at all. I've always... argue that Google fundamentally doesn't understand content because, they take the algorithmic approach to everything. To see them embracing this, I think at least even just for this initiative is really good. And seeing, having Apple have actual news editors coming in for, the Apple News program. I think that all of these things are really good signs that, hey, you know, there's a place for both of these worlds to live together. We can have the power of the algorithm, but also still have the human touch, because as you said, it'll be decades before we can replicate so much of what's important that can only be known by judgment and, frankly, experience.
Absolutely. And the new resources that I mentioned include BuzzFeed News, which launched an iOS app yesterday called BuzzFeed News. That is really a great app, and that is mostly human curation, but there is some algorithmic and software help behind that. Twitter's Project Lightning, which Kurt mentioned, which you covered yesterday on this show, this is something that was, speaking of BuzzFeed, you know, they got the scoop on this. This is essentially a way to put together not just news, not just the news events, but also the event television, the kinds of things people chatter about in large numbers on Twitter. They want to package it together. That'll be partly algorithmic. Apple News, we don't know a whole lot about Apple's news app, which they're going to include on iOS 9. And but we do know that it's going to have a heavy emphasis on human curation and human editing. And the other really exciting product is LinkedIn's Pulse, which Pulse used to be purely algorithmic.
Yep.
Now they have a whole editorial department to make that much better, and it is much better. So exciting. I think that finally these apps, this combination of human editing and curation plus algorithms, is finally going to make these apps better than newspapers, better than Google News or whatever. I'm really excited. As a big news fan, I'm really excited about this whole movement. So very cool stuff. Well, Cuba is what you might call a little light on public Wi-Fi hotspots. For example, Cuba's main city, Havana, which has a population of 2 million people, has one, count them, one Wi-Fi hotspot that's open to the public. But now, a Cuban newspaper reports that the government's telecom monopoly will open 35 new Wi-Fi hotspots around the country. The bandwidth will be capped at 1 megabit per second per user, and access will cost $2 an hour. But that's about half the price of existing Wi-Fi hotspots, or I should say the existing Wi-Fi hotspot. But even $2 an hour is a ton of money in a country where the average wage is about $25 per month.
I was going to say that's better, but we're...
You have to have relatives in Cuba just to use the Wi-Fi there. I mean, I'm sorry, in Havana or somewhere in the United States or somewhere outside of Cuba, because at $25 a month, you're not going to work two full days to use a 1 megabit per second connection for an hour. I mean, it's just nuts. Anyway, it's good to see something happening there, but it may take a while. I've heard stories of people visiting a internet cafe in Havana where they have these old, like, big CRT monitors, and they have the monitors facing an opposite direction. So you basically have your back to the other users. Like, there's a row, and then there's a row like this. And then they have a uniformed official from the government walking and just looking at all the screens.
Wow.
Pacing back and forth. Really amazing. But it may take Cuba a while to really get online. We'll see how that goes. Well, the Electronic Frontier Foundation's annual report on how well internet companies safeguard their users' data against government snooping praised Apple and slammed WhatsApp. The EFF's Who Has Your Back report says WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook, has adopted, quote, none of the best practices we've identified, unquote. AT&T was the only other company sharing the bottom with WhatsApp. Facebook itself, however, did very well, earning 4 out of 5 stars. The 5-star companies, the very best ones, being the, you know, that's their highest rating, were Apple, Adobe, Dropbox, Sonic.net, the Wikimedia Foundation, which runs the Wikipedia, WordPress, and Yahoo. I love this report, Christina Warren, because this is specifically about protecting users against government surveillance, and it's nice to see some major companies doing very well.
Yeah, no, I think what's really interesting is how many of the companies that were listed kind of on the PRISM, you know, documents that leaked 2 years ago, who are now ranking so well in this report. And I think that all goes back to the revelations that were made the way that they were made, and the fact that so many of these companies have stepped up, even though those that weren't part of those revelations who were saying, we are going to be dedicated to transparency when it comes to government requests.
Yeah. And it's also interesting, as an iPhone user on AT&T, I mean, Apple's got a 5-star and AT&T's got a 1. So I don't know. I need a better carrier, I guess. In product update news, Samsung rolled out today their Samsung Galaxy J5 and J7 smartphones, which are pretty mid-range and boring, except for one interesting feature. They have front-facing flashes for using flash photography with selfies.
Nice.
Yeah, welcome to the future.
Now, have they been updated to not have the software or keyboard bug?
That is actually another story that's out in the news today. Samsung says they're going to fix it. They haven't fixed it. So, no, they if you buy one today.
So, you buy one today, it's still got the
bug. Still got the bug. Exactly.
Fantastic. So but at least you can take a photo of yourself with the flash, front-facing flash, which
exactly.
is always a good thing.
Exactly. And the NSA can just grab it or whatever.
Totally.
In other product update news, Microsoft's OneNote application got a new capability that makes a lot of sense. It's a to-do feature. You can add a to-do list. But what's interesting about it is that Microsoft rolled out the new feature not on its own Windows Phone platform, but on iOS, which further boosts OneNote on iOS. It's basically a verification that that Microsoft is really on board with iOS and being cross-platform. It's also interesting in light of the fact that Microsoft isn't going to force users to have a Microsoft account to sign up.
Nice.
So you can use the app without getting a Microsoft account. You just give them your email address and password, which is a normal thing for registering for an app.
No, this is great now, but it's interesting that they roll this out because they just bought Wunderlist.
Yeah.
So presumably they're going to be having to overhaul what they've just, you know, released in the future, kind of like the way they, you know, overhauled Outlook after they bought Acompli. So I think that, I think this is really interesting. I was having a conversation yesterday on Mash Talk, our Mashable weekly podcast.
Yeah.
And Pete Patchell, our tech editor, made a really good comment, which was that it almost feels like Microsoft has, if not conceded that, you know, Windows Phone is never going to become a thing, has really not just said that they're going to embrace other platforms, but has really said, look, for our own future, it makes sense for us to be iOS and Android centric if we expect to gain traction, which, might be sad for Windows Phone users, but I think is definitely the pragmatic and probably correct view that they need to be taking if they really want their services to take off. And that includes not requiring a Microsoft email address and not requiring rolling out features to platforms that have more engagement for their products first.
Yeah, I mean, and in a best case scenario, if let's say Windows 10 is awesome, Cortana is awesome, they've got a bunch of really great apps on iOS already. For example, I'm always talking about Photosynth, which is a really great way to patch
great
together
app.
Like 360. If they do enough of those kinds of things, I can see people going, you know, I'm using the apps, I'm using the desktop operating system. There are benefits, and I'm really into Cortana. There are benefits for me to move to Windows Phone. That's kind of the Google model. I mean, really, one of the best reasons to have an Android phone is the fact that you get really great, Google Now and all the rest.
I mean, and historically, it's even the Apple model. You know, we always talk about, you know, it all goes all the way back to the iPod. You know, the halo effect from owning an iPod was what got a lot of people to switch to Mac, which obviously also the iPod was what got a lot of people to pick up the iPhone. So, yeah, I mean, I think that it's a long play. I think for Microsoft, it'll take longer than it did for Apple and for Google. But I think you're right. I think if you can build, affinity based on your services by being on these other platforms, when it comes time to move to something else, people are going to be looking at your product in a different light than maybe they would have, 4 or 5 years ago.
Absolutely true. Well, in product obituary news, Apple finally killed the original iPad mini, which was the only non-Retina device Apple sold. So now everything Apple sells is a Retina device. 9to5 Mac reports that it was removed from Apple.com last night. But if you hate high-resolution screens, you can still buy the tablets in the refurbished section of Apple's online store. And, of course, third-party stores will still sell it. There's inventory out there. So if you just like, lousy screens, this is your big shot.
And it is important to note too that even though it looks like they finally sold out of their stock. I have to think that's the only reason they were continuing to sell it. Even though you can't buy it in stores anymore, or Apple stores, I guess it will still get iOS 9, will the iPad too.
Yes, so. Yes, great point. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Scott Patterson, who posted this picture on Google+. He says he watches Tech News Today at work while running his CNC fab cutting machine. I had to look it up. CNC stands for Computer Numerical Control. And he uses a Bluetooth headset to hear it all. There it is. Very cool. Very cool. Interesting. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup or your CNC machine and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Christina Warren, besides monitoring Newt Gingrich, what are you working on these days and where can people see it?
Well, I'm working on a couple things. So you can find me at Mashable.com, obviously, and I'm film_girl on the Twitters. But I'm working on a kind of an explainer analysis of the whole Taylor Swift 1989 not being on Apple Music, because that combines two of my passions, Apple Music and, of course, Taylor Swift. So I'm working on that. I'm also working on a story, Vote, which has kind of become a VOAT.co, which is sort of a Reddit replacement service. Not a great place to be. Well, their host in Europe pulled the plug on them. And, which I think is really interesting and actually opens up some interesting free speech questions. Personally, I would say even if you're a European country, maybe don't host in the EU if you've got the sort of content they're doing, because they're a lot more likely to pull the plug. Even though I find most of the content on that site distasteful, I have to admit, as a free speech proponent, I'm a little bothered by hosts pulling content that they find objectionable, because when it's not illegal content, I have some issues with that. So kind of going to be diving into that a little bit today. And anyone who follows me on Twitter or Instagram, you will be seeing tons and tons of photos tonight as I relive the late 1990s and early 2000s by going to see Third Eye Blind and Dashboard Confessional. So wow. I will re-become like a 15-year-old girl tonight, and it's going to be exciting.
Wow. Very interesting. Mashable film girls, you know, you have the what's her name? What is the name of that singer you just mentioned?
Taylor Swift.
I know you're always mentioning Taylor Swift.
And I love her.
Yeah, you do. You have the Taylor Swift.
I do.
So anyway,
so it's amazing when I finally get to write about her, like from a tech angle, sort of.
Well, just don't read what they're saying about her on Vote. That is an objectionable site, and they need to follow in the footsteps of Pirate Bay. They really know how to keep a site going when everybody's hunting them down. Everybody was in prison, and they still had it
and
up
it was
running.
Still up. Yeah. It was still up.
So, you know, look into it. Vote, people. All right, Christina, thank you so much. We will see you next time.
See you next week,
right,
Mike.
Bye-bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on iTunes, or you can choose another way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And you can watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC. At twit.tv, just press the live button. And if you're ever in this neck of the woods, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. Just send email to tickets@twit.tv. And if you'd like us to help us grow that audience, here's how you can do it. Just post a link to twit.tv/TNT on your favorite social media site and tag three friends along with your recommendation to subscribe. You can follow me on all the social networks at elgin.com. And don't miss Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every single weeknight. That is the Tech News Today. This show is technical directed and edited by Brian Burnett. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. And happy Father's Day to all you dads out there. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you Monday.